Well, he's hiked all the Blue Blaze trails and made dinner out of snails. Ranger Colin.
Ranger Colin.
Ranger Colin.
Ranger Colin.
And he knows every kind of ant. And he stores squirrels in his pants. Ranger Colin.
Ranger Colin.
Ranger Colin.
Ranger Colin.
Well, he can tell the time by the placement of the sun. And he can turn a giant mushroom into a hot dog bun. Oh, when he's chased by a bear. Well, he just stops and stares. Ranger Colin.
Ranger Colin.
Ranger Colin.
Ranger Colin.
And if he's hungry for some protein, he eats emerald ash borers and soybeans. Colin.
Ranger Colin.
Ranger Colin.
Ranger Colin.
When people leave their litter around, well, he just starts crying. And hey, is that a mountain lion? Oh, nope, that's a deer. Hey, does anyone have bug spray? West Nile virus is hungry for Ranger Colin.
Ranger Colin.
Ranger Colin.
Ranger Colin.
He sure could use an Eagle Scout because deer ticks freak him out. Ranger Colin.
Ranger Colin.
Oh, Ranger Colin.
Ranger Colin.
And now he's pretty sure he just spotted a hairy-chested nut scratcher. Ranger Colin McEnroe.
Yay!
All right, let's have some applause here out in the woods, too. We are live from the Connecticut Forest and Park Association. Well, we sort of are. We're really out in the woods. We are in a clearing in the woods doing a radio show. And I do want to say when we first arrived here today and sort of plopped all of our equipment down on this little kind of little clearing off one of the trails, my son, who's with us, looked around and said, "Whose idea was this?" Which is something we try never to ask ourselves in these situations. But who knows whose idea it was. But we wanted to do a show about the incredible Connecticut Trail System, and it seemed right, because it was so obviously an impractical idea, to try to take the show out onto the trail. Somehow or other, we've done that with the help of the CFPA. And we've got some guests here. First of all, despite the fact that we're in the woods, and I swear, we are in the woods, we have a bunch of benches out here in the clearing, so there's more people here in the woods as an audience for this show than was at our Springfield show, which was actually held in an auditorium, so go figure. And we're going to talk a lot about trails, but also we're going to be talking to our state archaeologist about the things that he finds in the vicinity of these trails, all the incredible Connecticut history and ancient sites that are out in the woods, sometimes in close proximity to these trails. We're also going to hear a little bit more about the sort of the ecosystem of the trails. Talk very specifically about the emerald ash borer, which is the latest thing that's keeping us up at nights worrying. But let's start right away with the trails themselves. Claire Kane is here. She's a stewardship director for the Connecticut Forest and Park Association. And Jeff Meisner is a hiker. He has hiked every Blue Blaze trail in Connecticut. So I'll just sort of cross-examine you about each other. Claire, if it's true that Jeff Meisner has hiked every Blue Blaze trail in Connecticut, how many miles has he hiked, at least discreetly?
Well, this hasn't been proven, Colin. This is still a suspicious claim he makes. But if we give him the benefit of the doubt, he's hiked 825 miles across Connecticut.
Can we just sort of talk about how these trails come to be? I mean, I've hiked a lot of these trails, too, and I just assume that they're dropped here out of the ether for my enjoyment, but I would imagine actually somebody actually works on them, and that somebody is probably you and a lot of other people, right?
Well, actually, it's really not me. We have a whole army of volunteers who are out doing the work on the ground. I'm very fortunate to be able to sit back and watch them labor away, and they're doing all of the clipping and clearing and blazing and all the hard work that keeps the trails open for the public.
And what's the biggest enemy of a trail? What makes a trail hard to maintain?
There are a few things that make a trail hard to maintain. Big storms make a trail hard to maintain. Erosion is one of the biggest destroyers of trails. Water, we're always trying to manage water on our trail system. And then, like, illegal activity, that's also something that's tough to manage.
Illegal activity?
Illegal activity, yes.
So that would be...
That'd be like folks driving their ATVs down a hiking trail or something like that.
Yeah.
Yep.
I didn't know whether people are being, you know, whether mob hits are out here or something.
Well, you never know.
So Jeff, first of all, what give us a couple of your favorite places. If you were telling a novice, a rookie hiker, what trails to hit here in Connecticut, where would you send them?
Well, I think the prettiest place I've ever been is the intersection of the Regicides Trail with the Quinnipiac Trail. It's up on a hill Very pristine, beautiful, and you can't see anything else man-made, even though it's in the middle of Hamden, practically. So,
the Regicide Trail would also be a source of illegal activity in the past.
Oh, that's
right?
A long time.
Long time ago.
I think they got
nobody
over
really.
That. Yeah, yeah.
So, what makes that so beautiful? What makes it so great?
It's just a pristine hill, lots of moss, ferns. You can sit on the edge of the cliff, and 10 feet away, the hawks will just hover in the air out there. You can watch them. It's really pretty.
And what prompted you to, at what point did you decide, I'm going to hike every Blue Blaze Trail in Connecticut?
Well, I've always been a big hiker, and I was interested in just seeing all the differences that are out there. There's so many different experiences and things, and as you go across the state, you know, some are very pretty hilltops with views, others are more wood-like. Just a calm woods road, maybe past an old town foundation or something. So there's a lot of different situations out there, a lot of different places to enjoy.
And to the, I'm going to ask you both about this, but to the fairly novice hiker, in terms of when you set out, what you need, let's say you're going to go for a 4 or 5 or 6 hour hike. I will say, my son is here. You remember the day that we hiked in Bear Mountain in Salisbury and we're fighting over the water bottles at the end? It was like we lost all loyalty for each other. We just didn't have quite enough water. You know,
it's called bonding. That's bonding. Yeah.
That's right. Give me that. No, you're 11 years old. You don't need as much water as I do. But so water would be a pretty important thing. That's one thing I learned on that particular day. But yeah, I'm going to ask both of you. But Jeff, what about that?
A good pair of boots is critical because some of the trails, especially when it's wet out, they're not all smooth. There's rocks and things. The boots will help. I always try and bring water, snacks, gear, clothes for the weather, depending on what it is, and a first aid kit. That's important. You never know when you're going to skin your knee or something like that.
Claire, do you leave anything out?
I think it would be pretty helpful to also have a map and maybe a cell phone, just in case you get lost out there. We get lots of calls from hikers who have taken a wrong turn. So it helps to take a map and helps have a cell phone just in case.
Wait a minute, you get calls from hikers?
No, we do.
Where do they call? What number? I mean,
well,
don't give it out now because some idiot's going to call. But
we don't always know. They say, I see a blue blaze. Can you help me?
And they're calling the Connecticut Forest and Park Association?
Yes.
It turns out the phone number is on some of the blazes.
Oh, really?
And they're like, I don't know where I am.
Yeah. You definitely want to go out with a Sharpie and
cross that out.
You don't want that number for a good time. I mean, it's a pretty straightforward system, right? I mean, I don't know, how lost can you get, Claire?
It's not that hard to get turned around in some places. I mean, the trails do wind through the woods, and we have a bunch of different loop trails that come off of the main system. So you have to be aware while you're out there and follow the blazes.
Mm-hmm.
We sell the Connecticut Walkbooks, which are a great resource for folks who might not know where they're going and want to explore a new area. It'll give you the basics of topography and where the trails are and that sort of thing. So it helps to be prepared for sure.
And let's, in terms of, as long as we're being prepared, Jeff, give us this kind of a sense of what kind of, I'm going to look out at the audience. How many people here have ever seen a bear on a trail? Anybody? Okay. You guys, okay. All of them actually have seen bears. No, actually not. So, Jeff, you have seen a bear.
Oh, yeah. I saw, I was going up a hill and there was a mama bear and two babies, so we decided not to get very close because they can get excitable. So we just hid behind a tree and took about 45 minutes for it to cross across the trail, and we went on. But
I just want to say also, we are so incredibly safe today because I've hiked all over Connecticut, all over Maine, all over New Hampshire. I've never seen a bear, and I've never seen a moose. It's like I smell bad or something to them. Or like Bill Curry lives in Farmington. He doesn't go anywhere. The bears ring his doorbell, you know. I could go, I could stand in Alaska, you know, for 5 days and I would never see a bear.
Well, that's why we feel safe here, too.
Yeah, totally safe. No large, interesting form of life. But the moose are down here right now, right? Let's go down to Steve Broderick while we've got him here. Steve Broderick, moose are down in Connecticut, right? They are.
They've been migrating down from the more northern states for some time now.
Yeah.
And there have been frequent sightings in the northern part of the state.
And are you going to see them out on Blue Blaze trails, or are they knocking over garbage cans, or what are they doing?
Well, they're more of a wetland species, for one thing. The ones that you see are typically young males that are traveling long distances to find new territories. It's actually an amazing journey they sometimes take when you think about the fact that they have to cross interstate highways and some pretty perilous environments to get down here.
And you've seen at least one rattlesnake, right, Jeff?
Yeah. I jumped on one accidentally. Yeah. That was exciting. But
I don't think about this. For Nick Bellantoni is here. He's our state archaeologist. I've known him for years and years, and we're going to talk to him in the second segment about some of the things that are out there in the woods. As I say, some of the ancient finds and ancient settlements that are out in the woods. I don't really think about that when I think about you out in the woods. But do you ever encounter animals? Are there animals who are as interested in archaeology as you are?
Dogs are particularly good diggers. Yeah. I was just thinking about it here. I've never seen a moose. I've never seen a bear. I'm in the woods all the time with my work. And I've seen rattlesnakes. And so I've never seen a copperhead. And I suspect I've been near them, but they're so well camouflaged. But I've never seen a bear in the woods or a bobcat or a mountain lion.
And just in general, I don't know who knows the answer to this, but I assume for most large wild animals, it's all the same kind of common sense thing, right? You just stand there, you don't turn around.
Yeah, you certainly don't approach them and stay back. It kind of depends on them. Typically, they'll run away before.
Would that be about right for you, Steve? I mean, don't run away.
That's right, Make your presence known, but don't be threatening.
But you also don't turn around and wake.
More often than not, more often than not, they see you and you never see them. Between their sense of smell and hearing, and typically they would rather not cross paths with humans. So,
well, let me just ask you this: right now, is there a moose looking at me? Because I just never, I didn't see it. It could be that they're around me all the time and I just don't see them.
Well, and I'd point out the opposite: if you do want to see deer and things in the woods, go hiking in the rain is the best time. And if you can, go alone, because talking will scare them off and the rain will deaden the smell and you'll be able to see more wildlife.
You know, we don't think about that much. We think about also the hiking season as being kind of maybe late spring into the summer and certainly through the fall. But Claire, the trails are probably being used year-round, right?
Oh, absolutely. Year-round. Sometimes the winter is the best time to go out. It's quiet, fresh snow on the ground. You can go snowshoeing. A great time to explore the woods.
We actually used to go up Rattlesnake Mountain right off Route 6 in Farmington and go down it in the winter. Remember, my son's here. Remember, I lowered you down by your belt one time. I thought, all right, we shouldn't be up here. This is not a good time. We're here at the wrong time. Yeah. All right, we're out on the trail right now. We're going to take a little break. We should take a little break, don't you think? You'd like to take a little break. All right, we're going to take a little break. We're going to come back. We're going to do a campfire song. We're going to talk about the things that Nick finds out there in the woods when he's out digging.
Kumbaya, kumbaya, my lord, kumbaya, kumbaya, my lord, kumbaya, oh lord, kumbaya.
All right. That was the Rockfall Tabernacle Choir live from the woods. Here we are out in the woods. We're doing a show from a trail because we love the Connecticut Trail System, the Blue Blaze Trails. Most of us connect the show, hike them a little bit, maybe not quite as much as Jeff who's hiked all of them, every foot of them. We want to also turn the focus for a second over to Nick Bellantoni. He's our state archaeologist. He's been our state archaeologist since roughly the death of Nathan Hale, and he's found all kinds of things. Just listening to you talk to some of the other guests before we went on the air, Nick, you were saying, just going down the Appalachian Trail, how if you just walked that part of the Appalachian Trail that passes through Connecticut, how many historic or ancient sites would you be walking past?
Well, basically, our office, back in the early 90s, we did a cultural resource management study of the 55-mile corridor just in the Connecticut belt for the National Park Service. And, I think we came up with almost 300 archaeological and historic sites along that route. Now, we had about a 300-yard corridor to play within, but it's amazing the history that's out there that people, I think, walk over and don't even realize.
When we say a historical or archaeological site, what counts as something like that? I mean, how old does it have to be, or what makes it a site?
Well, basically, you know, in Connecticut, it goes back 10,000 years with the first peopling of this area by Native Americans. And we consider the state gives me authority to preserve and protect archaeological sites that are 50 years old or more, which means 12 years ago I became eligible for the National Register.
Exactly. Someplace that John Dempsey went camping.
So it includes that whole human history that's maybe not necessarily in standing structures or invisible context, but in ruins and or below ground deposits. As we sit here, I'm looking 15 feet away in the woods, and I could see historic ceramics and glass coming out of the side of the hill, which is probably indicative of an early 20th century dump. So I'm ready to dig right now.
We like to think of this as not that we're an early 20th century dump, all right? We're out in the woods now. But that raises something. We all should talk a little bit about this, which is that, like, Jeff, you, I think we were talking to Nick before we went on the show. There are parts of what we think of as the beautiful woods of Connecticut that were essentially kind of industrial areas.
Oh, yeah.
And talk about both of you, but you first, Jeff, a little bit about what you find up there in the northwest corner.
Well, the interesting part is the state, if you go back a couple hundred years, was almost denuded of trees. So all that you see around, all the forests we have, are more recent growth. Yeah. Up in that part of the state, in the western part, there was a lot of iron mines, and so there were smelters, there was all kinds of railroad cannon production, things like that. And to feed the iron mines, they had to get charcoal, and to do that, they would make these monstrous piles of logs, burn them down into charcoal, and put it in the furnaces. Walk along the Appalachian Trail today, and you can still see dozens of those big rings of charcoal out there in the woods. It's fascinating. So.
And Nick, didn't you say that in the People's Forest they found, tell that story about the People's Forest.
Well, the charcoal industry was huge out here, and we got a call a few years back from the People's Forest and along the trails. The state had given some loggers a permit to cut some trees down, and when they were taking some of the trees out in a skiff, they hit this little side of a hill that must have been about maybe 5 feet high. They clipped the side of the hill, and charcoal just came flushing out. And of course, they kind of had no idea what they had hit. They talked to the ranger. The ranger called an industrial archaeologist. They called me. And it was the remnant of one of these charcoal kilns. It's the first time I had ever seen one in Connecticut that actually still had charcoal in it. It'd be like leaving money in the bank and never going to claim it. It was there for them. But for whatever reason, it was left. And it's the first time I'd ever seen that. But it was a huge industry.
And I know up in the Mount Riga area up in Salisbury, they had an enormous forge there, right? Mm-hmm.
They did, and that forge is on the National Register of Historic Places. Some of the iron furnaces up in the northeast corner, examples through East Canaan and the Beckley furnace and so forth, and as you say, Mount Riga. You know, I bring people out there and I say, these are actually Mayan temples. And then I have to really tell the truth that they are iron furnaces. But they're an extraordinary industry that was very important in the Revolutionary and other wars. And
I think the anchor for the U.S. Constitution was forged in the Mount Riga.
From Salisbury.
Yeah.
So it was a wonderful industry. And you could, archaeologically, in the woods, you could still find remnants of that support industry.
First of all, you sort of reference this with the People's Forest story. So after people get lost and they call the Connecticut Forest and Parks Association, they find things and call you. I mean, how many calls a month do you get from people who've been out of the woods and think that they've seen something?
We get many calls. Our office serves as a clearinghouse of information, and I get people send me emails with photographs of artifacts they found or formations of stone that they think might be, and we love that. In many cases, I have to break their hearts and tell them it's absolutely a natural thing, but it's important for us because they have keyed us into some very important archaeological sites. A guy walking a trail with his son in Burlington, through the Burlington section of the trail, was walking through, tripped over a stone, almost fell on his face, and went back to look at it and thought it had kind of a different shape to it. He started digging it out, and what he found on end was a Native American stone bowl that dated to over 5,000 years ago. Wow. And he almost broke his neck over it. So, that was just a fabulous discovery for us.
And can we talk a little bit about just what kind of Native American artifacts are out there, or what kind of Native American, are there obvious former Native American settlements? We probably don't want to say where they are because people are going to be trepping all over them. But I mean, how many things in Connecticut are you aware of that really kind of represent places where Native American peoples lived before the arrival of Old World?
Well, because the Connecticut Trails cover so many kind of ecosystems, if you will, ecozones from lowlands to floodplain to highlands, you get a different kind of archaeological site at them. Native Americans, when they developed villages and were growing corn, beans, and squash, were down in the floodplains near the rivers with the fertile soils. We also see 4,000 or 5,000-year-old campsites up in the highland regions, and then usually next to wetlands and so forth. So, you know, when you think about the various, you know, someone that takes a hike in a trail can go through so many ecozones, and people utilize those zones for thousands of years and even into the historic period. So you have a potpourri of different kind of sites that are indicative of human habitations.
You know, we're all very excited about our new state slogan, which is still revolutionary. And I was saying to Jeff before and to Claire before we went on the air, for many years, the favorite hike for me and my son was something that we called the Mile of Ledges. It turns out, Jeff, there's like 16 places called the Mile of Ledges.
Yeah,
he said, oh, really? And Haddam? No, not even. But the one we did, you sort of start in Bristol and kind of hike into Burlington. And there is a Tory, yeah. I don't know, they call it the Tory Den. I don't know what that means exactly. This is where they used to go watch television, I think, during the Revolutionary War.
Well, Tories, of course, were British loyalists during the Revolutionary War. And some of them obviously didn't get along with their Connecticut rebel neighbors. And there were many tensions and conflicts, sometimes in very, not well reported here, but really a lot of neighbor-to-neighbor conflicts that were going on during the Revolution. And I guess some of them hid out into these caves to get away from some of their neighbors and prosecution.
Jeff, do you have, like, say, of all the sort of hiking that around here that you've done, your sort of your favorite historic area, the places that you've sort of come across that feels like Connecticut history to you?
Well, I like, if you go out to a place, Gay City is a park, but it's off the Schnipset Trail, I guess, off on that side. But it's got an old mill in the middle of the river. It's got a lot of foundations, and you walk through it, and you realize you're in what's in the middle of what was a town, and you can see where the barn was, where the shed was, where the house was. And there's a lot of those places throughout. A lot of the trails are on old roads that have since been decommissioned, and it's kind of strange to think of, wow, there was a whole community here, and now it's gone.
Yeah, actually, it's not really part of the Blue Blaze Trail, but Cotton Hollow in Glastonbury, you can walk down and see foundations of old mills on Naog River there.
Yeah.
Same kind of thing. You know, Claire, I didn't ask you right at the beginning here, but first of all, I don't know if this is something that you can roll off the top of your head, but he's talking about the Schnipset Trail, there's the Tungsis Trail, there's the Metacomet Trail. Do we know how many named trails there are as part of this overall system? Does anybody know?
Uh-oh.
No, nobody knows that. Oh, well, they're here. We could count them, actually.
I would say around 40.
And do you have your own particular favorite? I think I asked Jeff, but I didn't ask you.
You know, I really enjoy the Metacomet Trail.
Yeah.
You know, it goes up through the center of the state, follows the Traprock Ridge line, and it's now part of the New England National Scenic Trail. It's a really phenomenal stretch of trail through, you know, beautiful vistas off to the western part of the state. Really fantastic stretch of trail.
And I think it actually does include the little part that goes by 50 Cent's house in
Farmington. That's right. That's a real highlight.
Eventually, Nick will be up there saying, all right, well, these were rappers. This is a settlement of rappers. This is a hip-hop settlement from many years ago.
I kind of want to hear them do Kumbaya, you know, hear their version.
Actually, 50 Cent is recording a version of Kumbaya.
Yeah.
It'll be out later this year. And Nick, just back to you. So are you also able, or is anybody able to sort of figure out how many different tribes are represented by all the Native American stuff that you find out here?
Yeah, it's very confusing because in terms of, you know, when the colonists first came here, every settlement was a tribe. But they were, you know, confederacies. They were all interrelated and working together. But right now in Connecticut, we have 5 extant tribes that are still with us. But certainly there were probably 24 you know, before Europeans got here.
So I just want to set the scene for you once again. We're here on a trail. We're outdoors. That's why you can hear bugs in the background. But Steve, what kind of bugs are there that go, what are those?
Oh, anything from wasps to flying beetles this time of year. There are a lot of
what's that thing that makes that noise, that kind of ratchety noise?
Yeah, cicadas and later in the evening crickets. There's lots of things out.
Yeah.
It's amazing, really, how loud an ordinary Connecticut forest can be, particularly in the evening.
Actually, that noise is either charming or could drive you to the brink of madness, depending on who exactly you are and what kind of mood you're in, I think, at the time. But I do want to say, anyway, we're courtesy of the Connecticut Forest and Park Association. We're in a little clearing near a trail. If we walked out onto this trail, where could we go from here? Where would we be walking to?
There's about a 3.5 mile loop that goes through this whole property. It's been protected. We're right here in on the edge of Middletown. It's a fantastic, beautiful property that actually has some nice ponds and creeks running through it.
Yeah,
it's great.
This is
the newest trail.
This is like the newest trail in the whole system.
Highlawn Forest Trail system. Oh. Yep.
I do want to say that we're privileged to have an audience full of people who are here. I don't think we've ever had as many people wearing hiking boots at a show that we've done before. But not everybody. Some people have stylish sandals on as well. And I think we'll be hearing a little bit from the audience too as we go along here. Lydia's here with her mic. If people have things that I think we are definitely going to have to hear from Leo the wood carver, who's out there, who actually did Gandalf's staff, I think. We'll get to all that as well. I wish I could say that we'll take your phone calls, but that's the one thing we haven't figured out to do. We are here. We're live here at in the afternoon here on Thursday afternoon, but we have no way of to put your phone calls on the air. Want to mention who's here with us too, Claire Kane. She's a trail stewardship director for the Connecticut Forest and Parks Association. If people want to volunteer to help keep up these trails, I bet you'd be willing to accept their labor, wouldn't you?
Absolutely.
How would they do that? They'd call the number that's etched on the tree there, probably.
That's right. They can call that number. They can go to ctwoodlands.org. That's probably the best way to for us to connect them with a good volunteer job.
Jeff Meisner is a hiker. He's hiked every Blue Blaze Trail in Connecticut. Where are you hiking this weekend? Have you decided yet?
I haven't decided, actually. It's supposed to be nice and rainy, so we'll see. Maybe Tunxus area, who knows?
All right, good time to go out and see some moose. Yep. Nick Bellantoni is here with us. He's a Connecticut State Archaeologist. Steve Broderick is a forester and program director for the Goodwin Forest Conservation Education Center in Hampton. We're in the final segment here. We're going to be talking specifically to Steve also about some of the various challenges to our woodland environment. Everybody knows about the emerald ash borer, or maybe people don't. We're in a state of panic about the emerald ash borer at WNPR on a daily basis, but we'll be telling you a little bit more about that and other stuff to worry about as well, obviously. Nick, I want to just sort of swing back. I don't think I really sort of had a chance to finish out that thought. So in terms of the American Revolution, in terms of sort of what's out there, how much stuff is there that you've located that is specific to our American Revolutionary history?
Oh, gosh, we have a number of sites in the state that everything goes from, you know, the Rochambeau campsites to the site of two Revolutionary War battles, including the Battle of Richfield and certainly the Battle of Groton Heights in Groton. But, you know, you get these, you know, what do you want to say, support systems of that revolution, like the iron mines and the charcoal industry that supported that. So there's a whole series of site types that contributed to the war effort, along with the farms. But we really have a number of very unique archaeological sites here that are testaments to that revolutionary period.
And in terms of those battlefields, is it still the case that people find, I don't know, musket balls or things like that?
Yes, absolutely. As a matter of fact, we just reviewed a housing project in Richfield and had an archaeological survey done because it was in close proximity where the actual battle occurred, and the archaeologists out there found musket balls and other evidences. So, you know, it's still in the ground. It's right beneath your feet and right under the ground along the trail. I remember walking the along Miller's Pond in Durham, and we were about four of us hiking, and I was the last one. And looking down, right in the footprint of a person right ahead of me was a 4,000-year-old stone spear point sticking out of the ground. And I said, "You missed this." But it's right there. It's invisible many times. You don't see it. But it's the cultural landscape is a part of the trail system.
And you know, in these kinds of situations, like let's say there's a spear point sticking out of the ground, that's just sort of a random spear point, or do you then want to secure that site and figure out what else is there? Or?
We encourage people absolutely to report whatever they find, because it could be significant. It could be a stray, but that's one of the things we would investigate to determine if it's a remnant of a settlement or some kind of other occupation as opposed to a random thing. But yeah, you don't know until you investigate and open an area up further to find out.
And so the next time your phone rings, you really have no idea what era this is going to be from or anything like that, right?
Yes, and I'm foolish enough to answer the phone all the time, but so you never know.
You can definitely call Nick
That's right.
about stuff that you found out in the woods. even if you're not 100% sure about it. But don't call, well, try not to call the Connecticut Forest and Park Association if you're lost, all right? That's not so great. We do want to save some time and make sure we have some time to talk to Steve, too, about some of the other challenges to the forest environment. So we're going to take a break pretty soon also. I really do invite the audience, if you have things you want to say or questions that you want to ask the fascinating panel we have up here, that would be, are you getting ready to do that? Actually, why don't we take a break first, and then we'll do that highly interactive segment at the end here. So anyway, big round of applause as we go out here. We're live. We're out in the woods with a whole bunch of people.
Hiking shoes. Swag. Hiking shirts. Swag. Sunglasses. Swag. Sunscreen. Swag. Water bottle. Swag. Good food. Swag. Hiking shorts. Swag. My main jacket. Let's go hiking.
Get out of here, mosquito. You are totally not giving me West Nile virus. Oh, you want to play? Okay, come on, you little jerk. Come get a little bit closer. There. What? That was a hummingbird? My bad, but they should wear identification. Today's show was produced by Patrick Scahill, Betsy Kaplan, and me, with help from Lydia Brown, Katie Talarski, and Jean Amatruda. The part of Bill Curry was played by Smokey the Bear. On tomorrow's show, the nose plunges deeper into Olympic controversies. And now, back to Colin.
All right, yes, we will be back tomorrow with The Nose, our weekly cultural roundup with a panel of fascinating people. We've got fascinating people out in the woods with us now. I want to second a couple of emotions there and say special thanks to Gina and Amatruda, our chief engineer. Just, I don't know how this all works, but he does, and that's the important thing. He keeps us on the air here. Also, one of the big kids, Katie Talarski, who's the senior producer of Where We Live and the senior producer of WNPR. She came down here and helped us. Well, she did. She set the whole thing up, barked orders at us, and that's great because that's how it all works. Also, special thanks to Kion Wolf, who this morning I walked by her and I said, yeah, make up some song about how I keep chipmunks in my pants or something. And there it was at the beginning of the show. So I don't know how she does it. I don't give her a whole lot of time to do this either. But she does it anyway. So we've got a bunch of questions that are going to come from the audience here. But and before I get to those, I just want to quickly go back to the panel a couple of times. Nick reminded me during the break, everybody sort of reminds me of things that I've forgotten to ask them about due to my own ineptitude. And so Nick reminded me the last time we had him on the air was about the Leatherman. And some of these trails, I would imagine, do, in fact, go by Leatherman places. Yeah.
Absolutely. And of course, the Leatherman walked a 365-mile circuit from the Hudson River to the Connecticut River. And he did it punctually for 34 days, but he stopped and lived in caves, small caves along the way that he periodically returned to. And many of those caves are along the trail systems, if you knew where to look.
And so you were nodding, Jeff. You know some Leatherman places.
Yeah, well,
you're sort of the modern Leatherman.
Yeah. I get caves are fun. Well, I when my son was growing up, we'd go in the woods, and caves are always a hit because you can climb through them and lots of rocks. But there's a great one up Black Rock Park up toward Litchfield Way. And if you go down the trail there a little bit, there's a huge cave down there, and people still enjoy that in one of the Leatherman caves.
And Claire, you were making a really interesting point, and it kind of fits into what they're just saying, too, that it's sort of like the thing we should have said at the beginning, really, is what's the point of a trail? Well, I mean, the point of the trail is a great walk in the woods, but it's a little bit more than that, right? It's sort of almost a storytelling medium.
It really is. I mean, we're walking in the footsteps of the Leatherman. We're walking in the footsteps of, you know, our cultural history. We have our whole natural history around us, and these trails really thread through the whole landscape and bring all of these elements together. And we think of it as just a simple dirt trail, but it really is telling the whole story of our landscape. So it's a pretty unique way to kind of interpret our world.
It's a great point that you walk for 2 or 3 hours and you're going to cross the paths of Native Americans, of Revolutionary War soldiers, of the Leatherman, 50 Cent. Mm-hmm. You know, it really is the entire story of civilization and its subsequent decline.
Right.
We're going to go out to the audience right now. Also, I've got a lot of stuff I want to cover with Steve Broderick, but I also want to get the audience involved here. Lydia Brown, our excellent intern, is out there with a microphone. Let's see who she's found.
Hi, Colin. I'm Eric Hammerling, and I'm Executive Director of the Connecticut Forest and Park Association, and I wanted to thank you for being here. And first of all, I had a big question, a favor to ask of you, and that's if Kion might help us to write our next CFPA rockin' anthem. I think we really need one. So
You work that out with her. She's represented by International Creative Management.
Fantastic. Fantastic. And I'm a huge fan of your show and what you do. I wanted to just make sure to point out that we're on actually private land right now, and a lot of the trails go through private land. So we should make sure to thank all of our private landowners who host the trail on their properties. As you might imagine, that's not an easy thing for people to do, and we really thank them for what's being done.
This land belongs to Kanye West. I don't know if you're going to get that or not. But.
We do, by the way, we invite 50 Cent to different functions of ours, and he hasn't come yet. If you can help with that, we'd appreciate it. I also wanted to just mention that you have something at NPR that's very much in common with what we do here. We have trails that are available for free, and we ask people to support CFPA just as NPR has your programming, your outstanding programming available for free, and you ask people to support. So I hope people who are listening will find a way to support both of our great organizations. And the last thing is just a quick plug, because I'm the executive director and have to help with raising money for our organization, we do have an upcoming event on September 16th. It's in Burlington. I can't promise that anyone is going to trip over a 5,000-year-old bull. But it's at Sessions Woods Wildlife Management Area on September 16th, and it's called CFPA's Run for the Woods. It's actually a run and a walk, a 5K trail race, and a 5K walk. So we encourage people to participate and help support CFPA.
If you get somebody to dress up in a bear suit and chase them, I think you'd probably get them to run a little bit faster. Yeah. Actually, Sessions Woods is really this incredibly nice, talk about a little hidden treasure, too.
Yeah.
Because I worked out there for a long time in that area. And it took me a while to find it, but it's really nice.
It's really nice.
Really,
it's
pretty pond and all that kind of stuff. It's yeah. just great. We're going to pass the mic over to discredited ultimate frisbee playing Dave Morad.
It's actually disc golf, but that's all right. All right. We still have the itchy.
Like there's a difference. Foremost.
Yes. So early in the program, Jeff mentioned that the forests that are here are primarily new growth, that the state was denuded of its forests. So I was wondering, are there any areas in which you can find the old growth, some examples of some really ancient trees and such?
Excellent question. Who's going to answer?
That's a Steve.
See, that's a Steve Broderick question if I ever heard one.
There are some. They are typically small in size, and they are typically in areas that are removed from the road, somehow cut off from access so that they were not harvested for a long period of time. And actually, there's probably more older growth forest in Connecticut in small patches than we really think, because our forests were never these huge 6 foot, 8 foot diameter trees that towered 300 feet in the air like you find out west. A 300 year old white oak might not look very much different to the, you know, average person than an 80 or 90 or 100 year old white oak. You have to know what signs to look for. Older species, a lot of mountain laurel that's very large. Some of these kinds of things are indicators of older growth forests. And it's important, as our forest does age and mature, that people know to look for these things, and if they find them, to pay good attention to them, because we need more examples. Our forest is a little bit like the baby boomer generation. We don't have a lot of real young forests. We don't have a lot of real old forests. We got this big lump in the middle. That's kind of a result of the accident of land use history dating back to the charcoal days that Nick was talking about.
Yeah. And a lot of the forest is also very self-congratulatory, much like the baby boomers. And one of the real issues, too, I know we talked about this, I think, the last time we did a tree-related show, was, am I being attacked by a bug? Is that what you're
saying?
Yeah, I'm okay.
It's
though,
gone,
right?
Yeah.
Okay. I feel a little dizzy.
I didn't want to slap you.
It's not that we don't have wonderful forests, but continuity is kind of an issue, right? I mean, it's all kind of chopped up.
It is. You know, we are one of the most densely populated states in the nation. We're also one of the most heavily forested states in the nation. And the interaction of those two things creates unique challenges for us. Our forest over time has become increasingly fragmented into isolated parcels. And that's difficult. You know, if you're a fox and you hunt in one place and den in another place, and you suddenly get cut off so that you can't connect those two, it's a little bit like waking up in the morning and found somebody built a brick wall between your kitchen and your bedroom. You're in a lot of trouble. And so the connectivity on the landscape is very, very important as Connecticut continues to develop and grow its economy.
Okay, I think Lydia's out there in the crowd. Who have you found for us out there, Lydia?
Hi, Colin. I'm Norm Nader from Willington, and I'm a green author here to meet you today. And I have a question regarding the Bear Mountain Trail system. We've hiked it many years, and it's the highest point in Connecticut called Bear Mountain. And I was wondering just how old that trail system is, number one. And number two, the Appalachian Trail, I think, runs through that. And how long is the strip of the Appalachian Trail there?
I think 55 miles was the number.
55 miles
before,
through Connecticut.
In Connecticut,
from
yeah.
That corner that it dissects. That particular section, I don't know exactly how long it is in that section.
Yeah. Well, we get some advanced hikers here. So, Jeff, do you want to say anything about sort of that whole Bear Mountain area? That's the place where my son and I fought over the water bottle.
So yeah. There's a place called Under Mountain Trail. You can park just up north of Salisbury and go up in a big loop over the mountain. Bear Mountain's fairly rugged, but has 365 degree views. And oddly enough, it's not the highest point in Connecticut. The highest point is in Frizzell Mountain, which is just a couple miles away from that. It peaks in Massachusetts and slopes down into Connecticut, and so the high point is on the slope there. But you can hike from Bear Mountain down there in a couple miles.
My recollection on the Appalachian Trail, not too far south of there, there's some pretty rugged trails.
Oh yeah, right? Yeah. There's St. John's Ledges is there. Which in Connecticut is probably the most difficult stretch of trail anywhere. And I always imagine these through hikers heading up to Maine going through that. I can't imagine, you know, just getting down that is incredible. So it's a tough section.
All right. I don't know if that answered the question or not. You got somebody else for me up there, Lydia?
Yes, we have a special presentation.
Oh. We have this gentleman here, Leo, who's a carver. And he is a carver of staffs. So, yeah, just talking to the microphone.
On behalf of the Connecticut Forest and Park, the DEP, the Connecticut Wood Carvers, and going back to what you were saying a little bit earlier, we're part of the DEP thinning program for the walking sticks.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, we cut a bunch of them. And on behalf of the Connecticut Wood Carvers, DEP, and Forest and Park, we have carved UA stick. With
oh look, I did. Does have Gandalf? It does have Gandalf?
Yeah.
No, this is Gandalf. This isn't me. But when you say you're part of the thinning program, is this because I'm on a diet or something? Uh-huh.
If you're doing enough walking, it'll help.
This is. Anyway, thank you so much. I am so honored, Leo. Thank you. And I. This is a wonderful stick. It's a stout staff, which I'll be using to wrap my staff with on the heads and stuff.
It's not made for violence.
That's right. And it does have a little carving of sort of a Gandalf, or it's a little bit more Gimli the Dwarf than Gandalf.
Yeah.
I'm getting a little geeky here, I think.
Just, more of a resemblance to Colin.
And I've got the... I'm saying that. And there's a little leather thing to help it. So it'll be part of my Leatherman identity. Well, thank you so much. I'm very honored. And I'll be casting several spells with this. This is really, I really do feel a little bit more wizardly. So, and you really got some incredibly, bring the mic right up to your mouth and tell us about this. How long have you been doing this kind of carving? Because you've got some incredibly ornate staffs over there.
Basically, I've been carving for about 65 years.
Yeah.
And I teach carving. I do all types of carving myself. And I have one young lady here. She's been carving with us for 3 years.
Yeah, I saw her.
She did a fantastic job on the stick that she has with her.
She's totally the rookie of the year on carving for the stuff I'm seeing her do. That is really impressive. Thank you so much for this. I'm very honored. Thank you. All right.
You're welcome. Thank you. You have a good day.
I will use this with pride. I'm not letting anyone else touch it either. I have to sort of see where we are. Steve, I don't want to end the show without really getting into some of the stuff that I've been alluding to. We hear a lot about the emerald ash borer. First of all, for people who don't know what that is, explain what it is and why it's a problem.
So now for the downer part of the show, right?
Yeah.
Claire gets to talk about the beautiful trails and Nick the archaeologist. Right. I get to talk about pestilence and death. kidding aside, you know, this is an important topic because the emerald ash borer is a very destructive pest, and it's just been found in Connecticut for the first time within the last month, and so some measures are being put into place to try to slow the spread of this insect. It was discovered in Prospect, Haven County, less than a month ago. It was the next closest place that we knew of it existing was just the other side of the Hudson River in New York, which means it probably got here by hitching a ride on some firewood that somebody brought from one place to another. And one of the big messages we're trying to get out to people is don't do that. Yeah. It's very important that we slow the spread of this insect so we can buy some time to do research, to allow landowners to figure out what options they have should their property become infected down the road. And so not moving firewood around from place to place is important. In fact, there now, as of today, is a quarantine on wood leaving New Haven County. Firewood or ash logs cannot leave New Haven County without a permit from the Connecticut Agricultural Experiment Station.
This is complicated because a lot of people buy firewood without knowing much about the provenance of firewood. I mean, you get it from the open hearth in Hartford. I don't know where they cut it. So, I mean, how would we even know to make sure we don't do this?
Well, one aspect of the quarantine emergency regulations that are now in place is that anyone who moves firewood from any place in Connecticut to any other place is supposed to produce what's called a self-generated certificate of origin. You can print this off either the DEEP or the Experiment Station website, and it's an honor system, but yeah, you fill out where this wood came from and where it's going. But the bottom line is, if you deal with your local firewood vendors, the local folks in your community that are close by, the odds are great that, you know, that wood has come from close by and hasn't traveled a great distance.
You're not going to confiscate my walking stick, are you, Mike? This is Burke. This is Burke.
Doesn't look like ash from here.
It's like, it's okay. And as long as we're worrying about all this, I mean, what's the worry? What's the kind of, I mean, can you look at other places where this pest has been and get kind of a sense of what it does or what kind of damage it's capable of doing?
We certainly can. This emerald ash borer was first discovered in Detroit, Michigan in 2002. So in just a decade, it's traveled all that way from Detroit, Michigan to Connecticut, and it's killed tens of millions of ash trees along the way. It lives most of its life cycle as a larva or a grub, mining just below the bark, the soft part of the inner bark, and it's kind of like tying a tourniquet around the tree. It slowly kills the conducting tissue that allows moisture and nutrients to travel up to the growing parts of the trees. Little by little, within 2 to 4 years, it will typically kill that ash tree, and the signs of thinning in the crown, of slow decline of the crown, woodpeckers beating on the tree and stripping bark away from the tree, these can be signs that, you know, there may be emerald ash borer in that tree.
And it really is an invasive, right? It's something that it wouldn't be coming here as part of a natural biological cycle if it weren't hitching rides on things.
No, that's right. It's actually from China and East Asia. You know, it came a long way in packing material, no doubt, in the larval or pupal stage. You know, they pupate in the wood, that the tree gets cut, it gets sawn into boards for packing materials and shipped thousands of miles, and then they emerge when they get to the destination. The Asian longhorn beetle, which is another pest we've heard a lot about in recent years, infesting a large area up around Worcester, Mass. I came here the very same way.
We've only got about 30 seconds left, I think. In 30 seconds, Steve, is there anything, any one of these things we've gotten through okay? Because periodically we hear about the hemlock this and the... I want to end up with a happy note. Was it one of those that we survived and we're sort of okay now?
Well, you know, our forests have been dealing with exotic invasive plants and animals since probably a day or two after the Pilgrims landed on Plymouth Rock.
Right.
You know, I mean, this may be sooner than that. And in the vast majority of cases, Mother Nature finds a way to adapt and to adjust, often today with the help of researchers who find biological controls that will help keep their numbers down. You know, 25, 30 years ago, people were saying we wouldn't have any hemlock in Connecticut today because of the woolly adelgid. If people had gone out and cut all their hemlock down in anticipation of that, they would have done far more ecological damage than the pest ended up doing. So we want to be vigilant. We want to educate ourselves and make informed decisions, but we don't want to panic or despair.
Steve Broderick, thank you so much. How about a big hand for all these people up here? A hand for yourself. Thank you, Connecticut Forest and Park Association. And thank you to the staff of the Colin McEnroe Show and WNPR. We did it again.
Again. I'm Kyle.
Ranger Colin.
No, I'm Kyle.
Ranger Colin.
Okay, who's buying lunch today?
Ranger Colin.
Yay!